America. It is a nation of promise, potential, and pretty good pizza delivery. America is the only place in the world where thousands of people can unite for common goals. It could be fording around that somewhat entertaining cat video that your roommate's cousin's drinking buddy enjoyed on YouTube. It could be reading blogs that speak to your own inner personal interests that tell you things you already believe. Or it could mean taking back the system through the sunny online pastures of a better tomorrow. Assuming, of course, that it all didn't become obsolete yesterday. Okay, so I am here with Marcus Melitzas, who is the man behind the Daily Kos and also the author of Taking on the System. Marcus, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I wanted to first of all start off with a general query about this book. You point out in this book repeatedly that protesting is largely ineffective, that it is something out of a 1960s mentality, in part because protests aren't covered as much as they used to be by the media. And I'm wondering, is it your position then that protesting is by and large futile? And what is the purpose of it if it doesn't actually integrate into the media like this?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways you're going to affect change in the world today, and not just in politics, which is my realm, obviously, but if you're trying to change the way the music biz works or Hollywood or whatnot, two ways you can really affect change. One is you can influence the gatekeepers, the people who control each vertical. In the media, it's the producers, it's the editors, right? In Hollywood, it's the moguls. In the music biz, it's the record labels, right? You can either influence their behavior, or you can build a critical mass of people that will allow you to bypass those gatekeepers. So that's the two ways. So if you think you're going to a protest, in a traditional protest, a bunch of people yelling about free mumia and legalized hemp and imperialist out of Palestine and all that crap, if you think that's going to, if you want that protest to affect change, you either have to reach people or you have to reach the decision makers. Now, the decision makers, the elite, the gatekeepers, they can ignore it. That's easy, right? No problem. So you want to reach people. If you want to reach people, you got to grab media attention, right? That's the way you reach people. You grab the media. If you do something and the media doesn't cover it, did not happen, did not exist. So doing something that's tired and cliche and essentially obsolete and gets zero media attention does absolutely nothing towards affecting change. It may make you feel better. It may make you feel like you're actually accomplishing something. But at the end of the day, if your goal is more than just to feel good inside, if your goal is to actually affect change, then you've got to approach things a little bit differently.
What of A.B. Goodman and these two Democracy Now! Producers, as well as the AP photographer, who were arrested in St. Paul this last week? I mean, certainly, is that cliche? Or, I mean, this paramilitary escalation? This is their, that it's pointless for them to actually go? I mean,
at the end of the day, what's their goal?
Well, their goal was inquiry, but they was confused with protest. That's what I'm suggesting here.
That's a different story. Okay. If they got arrested when they were trying to do legitimate journalism and got caught up in something, that's completely a different situation. I mean, if they were out protesting in the streets, trying to accomplish something, then I'd question what exactly they were trying to accomplish. But I don't know the exact details of the situation, so I can't speak directly to it.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters, they are essentially committing a cliche. That is your position?
Are they affecting change?
Yeah.
How?
Well, they are getting the word out in their own particular way, I suspect.
But to who?
To themselves, I suppose.
Well,
to the people who are surrounding these particular events.
You
point out in this book the question of, if you're a small blogger starting out and you have only 200 visitors, you can in fact influence a handful of people, unless of course this does not matter in your particular.
I mean, is that the best way to reach a couple hundred people? I mean, to me, it's an economy of scale in a lot of ways. Now, or maybe not even economies of scale. Let's step back. In Taking on the System, in my book, I don't necessarily say that the street protest is obsolete. I mean, I give examples: the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
The immigration protest 2 years ago, the march on Jenna, Jenna 6, which is six youth, black youth in Jenna, Louisiana, who were charged with attempted murder for beating up a white kid in a school that had a lot of racial tension, right? White kids beat up some black kids. It was a misdemeanor, slap on the wrist, right? Black kids beat up a white kid, attempted murder. But in each one of those cases, the message was clear, it was singular, and it was part of a broader media strategy using whether it's using new media, whether it's radio, whatever it is, it was a part of a broader media narrative, and the protest was sort of the culmination of this long strategy with a singular purpose. I mean, the singular purpose is key. I was in Denver, and I saw a lot of these protests, and it's funny, right? Free Mumia and legalized hemp and U.S. out of Palestine, U.S. out of Iraq. It was just this amalgamation of 8 million different voices all shouting different things. The immigration protests were very, very effective because it was a single message. It's you cannot criminalize me for helping out my family, right? Because this is a time where the U.S. House, then controlled by Republicans, was trying to pass a measure that would criminalize people who helped anybody who was an undocumented immigrant, which is family at the end of the day, right? Who helps who in those situations? Family. So if you have a single message and it's part of a broader media strategy, I also talk about Cindy Sheehan, right? The first part of her protest when she camped out Crawford Ranch. It was part of a big caravan. The blogs were writing about it. There was a lot of stuff uploaded to YouTube. You know, it sort of built to a crescendo. They get there. Her message was so clear, right? It's like, I want the president to tell me why my son died in Iraq, right? Very potent. It really humanized the war in a way that a million people marching in the streets yelling U.S. imperialists out of Iraq could never do, right? This single mother with this really heartfelt plea to the president, camping out in the heat in Crawford. Very, very powerful. It was new, it was fresh, the media covered it. And I am very much convinced that sentiment against the war in Iraq turned a great deal because of that singular act. And it was a street protest. It was different, it was novel, and the message was very clear. And Cindy Sheehan really lost her way when she lost that clear message.
I'm curious, however, going back to the Free Mumia type, or the Wobblies or whatnot, who appear at many of these protests. Okay. If activism is essentially about promoting a message of unity, well, what of the Free Mumia protester? What of the Wobbly? What of the socialists or whatnot? I mean, don't these people have a voice? Are they not permitted the voice? I mean, aren't you essentially isolating them by saying, hey, calm down? Because, I mean, when you deal with a bunch of activists and you get them all together, you get a whole bunch of egos competing against each other. So I'm not certain if unity may very well be a good thing to get a message across. But in the case of this, if you can't quell these people, or at least kind of do a trade-off so that, hey, well, we'll do the Free Mumia rally next week if you go ahead and help us on board for this Hispanic protest or whatnot.
Well, I'm not saying that they can't go out and protest, right? They're more than free to, and the Constitution allows it.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. They're not affecting anything. Nobody's covering them. Nobody cares what they say. They're easily dismissed. They're tossed aside. They make themselves feel good. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it should be that way. But the reality is that that's what it is, right? They're going to get ignored and they're going to be marginalized. If an activist wants to actually affect change, he or she has to work within what essentially have become the rules of our society today. And one of them is be a little bit different, be a little novel, right? Do something different. You know, people want to congregate and chant Free Mumia and legalize hemp and all that other stuff. You know, all the power to them, but they're not doing anything except wasting their afternoon. And they can make themselves feel better, but at the end of the day, that's not affecting change. And it's clear that how many years have they been trying to free Mumia? And, you know, not only is the issue completely ignored, not only is Mumia still not freed, but it's completely an irrelevant issue in a national debate.
Efforts are meaningless? They have no value whatsoever aside from making themselves feel good?
If they want change, absolutely it does not have any effect.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, have they been effective? I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's the bottom line. Have they moved the debate in their direction in any quantifiable way? I would argue they haven't. I mean, I know Mumia exists.
Yeah.
But that's about, I knew
as
that.
Do, as do we all. You know?
I knew that 20 years ago, or however long they've been around. It feels like 20 years. It might be 20 years. But since then, since I knew the guy exists, I mean, nothing has moved on that debate. And in fact, it's become a sort of a joke.
Yeah.
Which is sort of kind of the opposite of what you want to accomplish.
Well, sure, certainly. Then let's talk also about the triangle. You cite Peter Dow's Salon article from 2004 in which he suggests that the power of influence could be framed as a triangle, and you have blogs on one side, traditional media on the other, and the political establishment on the third. But I'm wondering, so without these two sides, essentially, a voice is basically like a Free Mumia supporter on a blog or whatnot?
Right, by having, I mean, first the blog site, I mean, you could replace that with anything.
Or citizen media.
Citizen media, right.
Yeah.
Or activism or whatnot, right? But you have the two sides. You have the government in the Tao triangle is focused towards politics, but it applies to everything else. Government can be the studio moguls. It could be the record labels. It could be the sports execs, right? Anybody who's the gatekeeper. On the other side, the media really is the way you reach the masses, right? So you have to, and you know, the bottom line, you have to reach the people or you have to reach the influencers for change to happen. You don't do either of those, you're shouting into a void. I mean, it's, you know, this tree fall in the forest, nobody around to hear it, doesn't make a sound. I mean, that's basically the bottom line. It may be harsh, it may be unfair, it may be all these things, but this is really a practical guide, not a, you know, fantastical, if I had my way, how do we change the world? This is how you actually change the world. And it's based, the book obviously is based on real world examples. And I cannot think of a single instance of effective change happening where either people didn't demand it or the establishment gatekeepers didn't actually go ahead.
In the contemporary era, at least.
Even before, I mean, can you think of a...
Well, Vietnam, I would argue.
And wait. No, I mean...
But then that's also because people, they actually had the media coverage back then.
They did have the media coverage because at the time, and I cover this in the book, television was, the nightly news was brand new.
Yeah.
Right? The first nightly newscast was in 63, you know, Vietnam's heating up. They're looking for material to fill. And the protest at the time was brand new content, right? Ooh, you know, lots of people marching in the streets. They're angry. They're dressing very colorful. They're doing this great street theater. It was brand new and novel and compelling. So that was covered. You know, 40 years later, it's like, oh, yeah, there they go again, protesting in the street, right? You got to keep mixing it up. I mean, who wants to see the same movie over and over and over again, right? Who wants to listen to the same song over and over and over again? People like change. You got to mix it up to keep it interesting. And that's the key. And some of the best modern activism has been people who either on purpose or by accident, I think Cindy Sheehan by almost by accident, did something that was different than what has traditionally followed before it and thus made for compelling media, whether radio, television, internet, whatnot.
Yeah.
So that I mean, that's the bottom line. It's you know, I don't want to say, you know, people are using, you know, are wasting their time, but at the end of the day, if you don't see progress in that issue, you're not affecting change, you kind of are wasting your time.
But if you are calling for essentially unity of message, I mean, I'm wondering if you're replacing one type of gatekeeper with another. I mean, the mediums may have changed, the type of coverage may have changed, but essentially in mobilizing for a realistic message, I mean, aren't you becoming the gatekeeper?
I'm not deciding what that message is. I mean, so, and I am in a way a gatekeeper. The difference is that now anybody can be a gatekeeper. With the way technology has democratized media, you know, with your show, didn't have to get permission from ABC to have a show on television, did you? Or on radio, did you? No, you just did it. I mean, that's democratizing media, which is absolutely sort of the ideal. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is encouraging people. You know, you don't have to sit and wait for permission to do something. Just do it because the technology enables you to do that.
But on the flip side, I am not being quoted in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the like.
You're reaching people. You're going around them, though.
Yeah, well, I am. But the point is that you have an influence. You have a particular gatekeeper element to you that some person with a Blogspot or a Typepad blog does not. So, I mean, you know, let's talk about this sense of scale. Does scale matter at all? I mean, one point, you know, as I alluded to earlier, you write, if you cannot influence the flow of information, you cannot affect change on any substantial scale. Now, later in the book, again, you point out, well, okay, you're a small-time blogger. Get 5 people and change their minds. But since if that's not substantial, I mean, does it even matter? I mean,
individual basis, it wouldn't. Right, 5 people ain't going to change the world in any meaningful fashion. Unless you got a nuclear bomb in your suitcase, then maybe, right? But, I mean, in an activist sense, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to change the world with 5 people. But the issue here is the network ability of individuals to come together. You know, 5 people bring 5 people, bring 5 people, bring 5 people, right? It's only you have exponential growth of a message, which is how Daily Coast and other sites that have been successful, like mine, have grown, right? Because I originally started with, you know, 2 friends and my wife reading my site. My wife barely read my site, but it exponentially grew. So I wasn't having an effect at first, but later through the power of networking, that definitely changed.
You bring up the...
You asked a question before that didn't answer. And I'm trying to remember what the question was because I feel like I left you hanging on.
I think it was a unity-based question.
Oh, the unity. Yeah. The issue isn't every progressive needs to have the same message and otherwise, you know, we fail. But when you engage in an activism campaign, it has to have a singular purpose, right? So it's not a question of Mumia people shut up and work on universal healthcare. it's if you're going to do activism that's effective, you know, when Mumia people get together to do something, they should focus, and it should be only about Mumia, and designed in a way that gets media attention, right? So don't go to the local protest with your Mumia sign and think that you're actually accomplishing something on behalf of Mumia. Do something that it's 100% geared and focused towards pushing that message through the media clutter. And today, the media clutter is a lot different than it was in the 1960s, right? In the 1960s, if you want to have an anti-war protest, all you needed was CBS, NBC, and ABC to show up, or one of the three. And you had, for each one of those, you had a third of the country basically tuned in. 80% of the country tuned in to one of those three nightly newscasts every night, which is just mind-boggling, right? Now, of course, you have 500 channels on television. Yeah. You have satellite radio. You have guerrilla radio. You have online radio. You have internet. You have ethnic media. You have newspapers, community newspapers. I mean, the media world is so fragmented that it's easier to get media attention, but it takes a lot more work in a lot of ways to get the kind of penetration you used to be able to get with that.
Easier to get media attention, you say?
To get some media attention than it was to get that attention of that one producer at CBS News in 1960. So,
well, how so? I mean, cite an example here. I mean, you know, maybe for you, but maybe for again, going back to the hypothetical guy with the TypePad blog, maybe
well,
not.
Look at Cindy Sheehan. Who was she? I mean, when she started, she had a compelling message. It was crystal clear. It was relevant to the news cycle. It was singular focused. And people, you know, she started on, you know, indie media, and she started on sort of more, you know, lesser traffic sites, and sort of bubbled up. You know, eventually she was in the Daily Coast Diaries, kept bubbling up, right? Eventually became a blog sensation, kept bubbling up. Next thing you know, radio's covering her, kept bubbling up, newspapers bubbling up. Suddenly the nightly news are down there, right? So she worked her way up because it was a compelling, clear message. It was different. And it was at a moment in time that really sort of struck a chord with a large number of people. I mean, if you've got something that nobody cares about, at the end of the day, you know, you could be the most brilliant person with the most compelling cause, but you have to know how to get that word out and work the new sort of modern-day media landscape, which is just this fragmented world. And so much of it is people-driven. I mean, you have this base of people-powered media that you don't need to go to the corporate media first to get attention. You can bubble up through the grassroots stuff first.
But let's look at Cindy Sheehan. I mean, she has gone on, and now she's running as an independent candidate against Nancy Pelosi. And when Nancy Pelosi went on her last book tour, she was greeted almost at every city by people who were appalled that she didn't call for impeachment. And inarguably, Sheehan is speaking to that particular sector of people. You say nobody cares about what Sheehan's doing and whether she was more opportunistic or... Well, you just said, you know, nobody cares about what she's saying about her particular message. You just said this in your last answer.
No. I said they did care.
They did care, but then her message shifted. But I mean, what of
it? Didn't even shift. It got muddy. Suddenly she's hanging out with what's his face? Chavez down in Venezuela. Yeah. And she's protesting this and that. It's only like, who is she? And she decided that she was going to sort of carry the anti-war movement on her back when nobody asked her. She didn't need to. Like, she was a cog and a very important one, and she had a very clear message and a really clearly defined role. And once she stepped outside of that role, you know, she wasn't as effective anymore.
Well, you don't think she's being effective in any sense against Pelosi?
No, not at all. She single-handedly, and I believe this very strongly, and I think the data bears this out, single-handedly shifted support of the war, I mean, American opinion against the war. I mean, people supported the war.
Yeah.
And at the time she came on the scene, it was already starting, people were starting to get tired of it, right? But she really, really flipped it. I mean, we're talking 20-point shift in support. One person, right, I think shifted about 20 points of people who supported it to people who opposed the war. Now, you know, she's sort of tilting at windmills. I mean, she's not going to defeat Nancy Pelosi. The issue is, it's sort of been a dead issue for a while. That's why it's not compelling, because, you know, you don't need impeachment because the guy's gone in a couple months anyway. Do we all wish that would have been a stronger Congress? Sure, but those of us who actually pay attention to Congress understand that she didn't have a functioning majority. She has these freaking blue dogs that have been undermining her away. And the way I treat, instead of sitting there and getting angry at Pelosi because these blue dogs were undermining her, we're gearing up to challenge those blue dogs in primaries in 2010. I mean, we're going to go after them in a way that hopefully changes their behavior or even knocks a few of these guys out. So you also got to be smart about how you approach it, right? I mean, running against her to the point where she's going to get 5% of the vote, I don't think really accomplishes anything than say she's the 5% fringe.
But people are upset at Pelosi's failure to pursue impeachment. Is not this part of the equation in your mind? Is this something to at least consider? There is an active part, maybe not a majority part, but certainly a significant sliver of people who are extremely upset. Kucinich right now is trying to pursue this.
All right, I get it. Two ways to change, affect change. Faust triangle once again, right? You either influence the gatekeepers or you influence public opinion. All right, clearly influencing the gatekeepers didn't work. People tried. I wasn't one of those people, right? But people tried, and it failed, right? The Democratic leadership said impeachment's off the table. They should have never said that, but the notion of going to impeachment, to me, wasn't a very, I wasn't a supporter, but they tried. What's the other way? You build popular support for that. Now, is running against Nancy Pelosi in a sort of doomed symbolic gesture building popular support for impeachment? I mean, I would argue that it is not. Now, you may argue that it is. I'd love to see the evidence of that. But in fact, there's very little appetite in the public for impeachment. And nothing that Cindy Sheehan has done, and certainly not running against her in the primary where she's going to lose with, 5% of the vote, is going to accomplish that. Again, it may make her feel better. It may make impeachment activists feel better that something is being done. But if the goal is actually change, then you almost have to take a dispassionate look, take a step back and get away from what feels good. Because trust me, I'd love to see Dick Cheney and George Bush strung up in The Hague, right? On war crimes, right?
It's self a protesting cliche, yeah.
Right. I mean, I'm not going to kid myself and pretend that I wouldn't get incredible joy out of seeing that happen.
Yeah.
But we got to look at this from a more, logical approach. It's like, what is actually going to help change the country? What I've seen and the approach that the Democrats took with the impeachment stuff is that they said, you know what, we're not going to focus on impeachment because it's going to be so incredibly politicized that it's going to could potentially turn people against Democrats. But what we're going to do is we're going to pursue an agenda that is progressive. We're going to get blocked by the Republicans on pullout deadlines, on health care for middle class and low income children. On things like the minimum wage. We're going to pursue a progressive agenda. We may pass some of it, but probably not because they're going to block us because they're going to filibuster and whatnot. But then we're going to go to the election and we're going to tell people that's the difference between them and us. And then the people will decide. And I believe very strongly, if you look at the numbers, that the Democrats are poised for huge victories in the Senate and the House. And we're looking pretty good in the White House as well. And so we may not get impeachment. We may not get George Bush and Dick Cheney strung up in The Hague. But we may get a generation of real progressive governance in this country. Now, I believe it. Trust me. I know that I'm not going to trust those Democrats once they're elected with the big majorities as far as I can throw them. But that's why we're going to try to hold them accountable.
What about Ned Lamont in comparison to Sheehan? I mean, he managed to knock off Lieberman from the Democratic ticket. But here we had Lieberman the other night announcing himself to be a Democrat, even though he is an independent.
Yeah, he's an asshole.
Yeah, well, I happen to agree with that particular statement. But nevertheless, we're stuck with this guy in the Senate, despite the fact that he waffles around and despite the fact that, of course, there was that kiss image and the like. What makes Sheehan's challenge to Pelosi any different from Ned Lamont's challenge to Lieberman? Maybe it's a difference of scale, a difference of severity. I mean, it seems to me that both are driven by the same purpose.
Yeah, no. The difference is viability. At the end of the day, it's a question of viability. When we set out to challenge Joe Lieberman, there were several people who stepped forward. If you go back, there was a college professor that stepped forward, or there's some other gadfly type that stepped forward, right? And we took at those guys and said, no, these guys can't win, right? They don't have the money, they don't have the connections, they don't have the ability to present themselves in a way that they look like credible opponents. Ned Lamont stepped forward, and he had the money, which clearly in modern politics, until there is publicly financed elections, that is a factor. No doubt there's a factor. He had the money, but he also had, there's a story and there's a background, and that, in the way he spoke about the issues, that we saw huge potential. Now, in the early polling, Lieberman was absolutely crushing him, but it was never 95-5, which is basically what you're getting out of Cindy Sheehan, Nancy Pelosi's district. Because at the end of the day, big difference is that Nancy Pelosi takes care of her district. Her constituents actually like her. And Cindy Sheehan isn't even from that district. She lives in Marin, right? So she's carpetbagging into that district. And it's really tough to come into a place where people like the incumbent and say, I'm not even from here, guys, but I want you to vote for me instead of her, right? It doesn't generally work. Joe Lieberman was defeated in large part not because of his Iraq war stance, not even because of Ned Lamont's money, but because he had a documented track record of basically ignoring Connecticut. He had his own agenda, and Connecticut was sort of an afterthought, right? There were the people he went to every 6 years to get their vote and then went back to doing his own little Joe Lieberman show. And that's what we fed off a lot. Notion that he hadn't been in Connecticut for 2.5 years at one point until the primary started, right? I mean, he really didn't care about his own home state. So you got to look at factors like that. There's a lot of Democrats that I look at that I would kill to challenge, but they have great constituent service, and the locals really, really like them. And we can't touch that, you know, because at the end of the day, it's a democracy, and they represent a certain, unless you're the president, you represent a very specific constituency. And if that constituency is happy with the job of the incumbent, almost nothing you can do about it. You can only find those, and there's plenty. You know, I've identified about 10 to 12 for 2010 that are bad Democrats, corrupt, corporatist, you know, lost sight of who they are, and in addition to all that, also have poor constituent service and sort of neglect their district. And that's where we're going to have to focus. Now, I've identified about 12 of those districts. Finding candidates that are credible candidates is going to be another big hurdle, you know. If we're lucky, we'll get 6. And then we can really, really focus hard. And if we're successful with, let's say, 2 to 3, then we can use that as a sort of a whip to sort of whip the caucus in line when they sort of start forgetting who they're serving, you know. It's not AT&T, it's not Enron, and it's not GE, it's the people of their districts.
Gotcha. You bring up the efforts to organize a Democratic presidential debate in Nevada, with this debate being sponsored by Fox News. You write, there was nothing wrong with being a conservative propaganda outlet, but there was everything wrong with Democrats helping validate the organization as a legitimate news outlet. Now, tonight, Barack Obama is appearing on the O'Reilly Factor. Does this not represent the same effort to legitimize Fox News? I mean, what is there any difference between this and the presidential debate and reaching out to a group of people? Maybe a few of them might change their tune, but essentially it's biased against him.
Yeah, you know, if Fox News just said, you know, we're the conservative, you know, voice of America, I wouldn't care if anybody showed up to their shows and whatnot. The problem really comes down to is that they pretend to be fair and balanced. And by creating that sort of persona that they're a legitimate news organization, they're taken seriously by the rest of the media world, and their bullshit smears ended up getting treated as actual legitimate news. Not as propaganda, not as agenda-seeking information, but as real, legitimate, unbiased news. So by going on shows, it does validate that. Now, if it was up to me, I wouldn't have Barack Obama go on Bill O'Reilly's show. Fox News viewers are the most reliably Republican constituency in the Republican Party. They vote more Republican. In 2004, they voted for Bush in greater numbers than gun owners, than NRA members, than conservatives. Self-styled conservatives voted less for Bush than Fox News viewers, right? They're lost. No, what Obama's doing right now is sort of saying, I'm not afraid of you guys, right? He's turning it into sort of a chest-pounding, macho sort of thing, which contrasts actually very nicely with Sarah Palin, yeah, who they're hiding from the news, right? She hasn't done a single interview except for People magazine since she was announced. So, and it's got its own propaganda component to it, which I actually respect very much, and I think it's clever. And he's not treating their news operation as legitimate. I mean, nobody thinks that Bill O'Reilly is really anything but a right-wing blowhard, right? Nobody pretends. The problem was when it wasn't Bill O'Reilly sponsoring those Democratic debates. It was Fox News Fair and Balanced, right?
Yeah.
CNN has conservative blowhards on the air. They have shows, right?
Yeah.
MSNBC now has, you know, definitely has conservatives, and now has Keith Olbermann. Finally, yay, a progressive on the air, right? Although
unless you could call him a blowhard too for some of his fulminations.
Some people could call him that. I appreciate him, and I expect very much that when we have an Obama administration, he's going to be just as hard on the Obama administration as he has been with the Bush administration if they do stupid crap, and they will. It's government, right? Eventually, they're gonna do boneheaded things. So, you know, again, you know, at the end of the day, I'd rather not. But I almost kind of respect that there is a propaganda component to his appearance tonight that is actually quite clever.
But this is essentially the same thing as a small-time blogger who is hoping to change five people's minds. I mean, isn't that a noble gesture, beyond a noble gesture, an actual effort on Obama's part to at least get through to people that is not reflected in McCain? I mean, you object to it, you say you wouldn't do it, but I mean, you're saying it's not worth
it's not worth the time. I mean, the bottom line, it'd be like George Bush coming on the Daily Coast, you know, and I gave him the forum. Do you think anybody on Daily Coast is going to be going like, oh, yeah, that George Bush, right? Actually, it's not so bad after all, right? I mean, this is a partisan hive, right? I mean, they're programmed to hate liberals. I mean, you have Bill O'Reilly, who on almost a nightly basis says, I am worse than the KKK. I'm worse than the Nazis because apparently I've been lynching people and murdering millions of Jews. Last, you know, didn't know about this, but according to Bill O'Reilly, I have been. And what he's doing is he's going on there. I don't think it's just trying to get any of Bill O'Reilly's viewers to change their mind. He's going on there to show that he's not afraid of conservatives, right? Which is sort of a different goal. Now that said, people watch Bill O'Reilly because the vast majority, there's a small percentage that see him as comic relief, right? But the vast majority see him as, they respect him. They, you know, they soak it in, and this is, I believe, what Bill O'Reilly tells me. It's a Rush Limbaugh model, right? It's like the Ditto Heads. Oh, great, Rush, tell me what to think about this issue because, you know, I'm lazy and bored and don't want to think about it myself. Barack Obama may go on the show, and he may say all the best things in the world that leads O'Reilly's listeners to think, oh, that was pretty reasonable. Then O'Reilly spent the next 20 minutes saying he was so full of shit, he lied about this, he lied about that, why wasn't he honest? Boom, it's all gone.
You genuinely think the majority of O'Reilly viewers are just essentially like Ditto Heads? I mean, a lot of people listen to Limbaugh,
The numbers. I mean, I'm going...
Which numbers specifically?
This is polling done. I mean, I've linked to it several times. I mean, pollsters have looked into this. Pew has looked into this, right?
Okay.
Fox News viewers are the most reliable Republican constituency than in the Republican Party. And it is. I mean, it's a propaganda outlet of the Republican Party. I mean, this is what Fox News is all about. So there are very few smears that haven't, you know, not just anti-Obama, but anti-democratic, anti-progressive smears that haven't had a root or have been championed by Fox News and its personalities.
I wanted to actually ask you about your site. I mean, the Daily Coast was responsible for spreading the rumor that Sarah Palin's son, Trigg, was her daughter's son. Howard Kurtz, the Washington Post, actually asked you about this, and you said to him, our people are doing the vetting. Even if some of it is hitting dead ends, other ones are striking direct hits. My role is to sit back and let the citizen journalists do their job, and I amplify the stuff that shakes out. But I'm wondering if this is misinformation or conjecture. What is this doing to increase the level of political discourse or to even help the credibility of Daily Kos? I mean, aren't you essentially doing the exact same thing as the people who looked to Al Gore and said, oh, he invented the internet, even though, as you point out in your book, well, it was intended as a joke and it was completely misconstrued. I mean, what of this? I know you have an engineer that you've hired. Why not hire a fact checker? Why not try to get it right? Why not actually go ahead and push the levels of reason higher than the mainstream newspapers who sometimes get things wrong?
So you're talking about me becoming the ultimate gatekeeper online by stifling anything that hasn't been vetted by the great and mighty coast. The idea is open source. It's a community. People are talking. They're having a chat. It's like the corner. It's like a sports bar. We'll get together, and they talk about things. And, yeah, some rumors, some misinformation happens. But as a whole, the community shakes things out. This guy who wrote the one diary, which is now infamous, right?
Yeah.
Eventually took it down because enough people at Daily Coast pointed out the flaws in the argument. And so the community was self-policing and finally realized, okay, this is a dead end. Now, of course, there was a lot of irregularities about that pregnancy that still pretty much are unexplained. I don't think they're explained by the original theory, but there's some weird stuff. I mean, you don't have your water break, and then you wait 10 hours to go to the hospital because you give a speech and get on a commercial flight to Seattle and sit around and then take a commercial flight to Anchorage and take a one-hour drive over to your hometown and then have a baby when your water breaks, especially a special needs child like Craig, you know, was. But that said, it's her choice to make those decisions. You know, I'm a progressive. I'm assuming a doctor said it's okay for her to do that. You know, it's between her and her doctor. I am not Sarah Palin. I'm not trying to inject my morality into the public space. But there are some weird things that let people ask questions. I think that's perfectly natural. And they led to the reality that Bristol was pregnant, which normally wouldn't be relevant, except that her mother, one, is a fierce opponent of sex education and is all about abstinence only. And two, she vetoed funding for a halfway home for pregnant teenagers, right? So it actually matters when you're legislating morality, how that affect, you know, your family life, how that affects your family life. I mean, the hypocrisy and everything else that's attached to it. Now, that said, there was also a great deal of investigative stuff that came out of Daily Coast that is now part and parcel of the confirmed background of Sarah Palin, like her association with the Alaska Independence Party, the separatists.
Sure. But I mean, but I'm talking about this misinformation here. I mean, well, people are going to catch wind of this early part, and then they're going to look to you and say, well, I don't know about Daily Kos, because sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, and I have to constantly fact-check top of this. I mean,
good. I want people to look at media with a skeptical eye. Are you kidding me? If people did that, would we have rushed to war in Iraq so quickly if people didn't just blindly trust Judith Miller and the New York Times reporting?
Even at the expense of your own credibility?
It's not credit. It's a question of credibility. The question, not my own. I didn't write this stuff. Right. Daily Kos people, I mean, this author's credibility might be impacted. I didn't write that stuff.
But the fact of the matter is that DailyKos.com is in the link.
So that would be like assigning a paper, blaming a paper for a letter to the editor. You know, that you know, and saying that this paper said something because this letter editor ran. Ultimately, the issue is Daily Kos is an open and freewheeling community. There are rules, but as long as you stay within those rules, you're allowed to speculate. You're allowed to ask questions about important political matters. Where I put the foot down is when something is discredited and people keep on hitting it over and over again. 9/11 was an inside job. George Bush stole the election in 2004. There are things that when the evidence is very, very clear and people insist on rehashing it. So this, you know, the Bristol Palin was the mother of Trig Palin. If people were still harping on that today, even though it's pretty much, you know, it was a dead end. At that point, I say, okay, no more.
Right.
There's no need for it. Then it becomes conspiracy mongering. It doesn't become. But to ask questions and to investigate is really no different than what newsrooms do. The only difference is that we do it open source, and people see it out in the open, as opposed to it being behind closed doors where dead ends sort of get hushed up and thrown away. I mean, I worked in the newsroom. I've done investigations that didn't pan out, right? The only difference here is that it's done completely out in the open. And the ability to do it out in the open is what makes it so powerful. It's what led to Josh Marshall really getting to the heart of the firings, the politicization of the Justice Department by Alberto Gonzalez by firing all these U.S. attorneys all over the country.
Yeah, I totally hear, and I'm very much with you with
the
idea.
Good, you get the bad. I mean, you can't have one or the other. I mean,
I'm with you on the package deal. Look, as someone who likes to collect facts for his own site, I'm totally with you for that. But nevertheless, shouldn't there be some kind of confirmation process so that, you know?
There's 188,000 registered users on Daily Kos. I mean, it's literally impossible. There are 1 million comments every 3 weeks on Daily Kos. 1 million comments every 3 weeks. You can't possibly vet that. It's impossible.
And also, if you are a person stumbling onto a particular hyperlink, you can't go through those 1 billion comments because you want to see what's on the main page, and maybe you might read through those comments or maybe not. I mean, you know, essentially, what is there on the main page? I mean, you know, that's what matters first and foremost. And if there is a piece of misinformation or something that is not necessarily confirmed, I mean, yes, it might, in the comments, you might be able to find a little breadcrumb that goes back to the first thing, and you go, oh, okay, that fact's not right. What I'm suggesting here is that, you know, I'm with you about...
Well, that rumor never made it to the front page of Daily Kos.
But it was linked on Reddit. It was linked on a number of sites.
That's not my fault. I mean, should I police what Reddit does and what Dig does, because people are linking the stuff in the diaries or in the comments.
Well, you have access to the logs. You have access. If it's at the very top of Reddit, I would, it would seem to me that I would have a responsibility to put an update tag saying, okay, we've checked this out. This aspect is not right. Now, pulling it down, okay. But that's not my job.
My job is to provide a platform for people to engage and participate in their politics. There's good. There's some bad sometimes. But the community is self-policing. The way they and this is a perfect example. The community on its own looked into the story and then declared it was bogus and basically shut down the story. This is the way it should be done. You know, we didn't sit there and cling, you know, like the New York Times clinging to Judith Miller's reporting on Iraq, right, and pretending that it was actually legit when it was all one big propaganda outfit, right? Open source, people are accountable for what they write, and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. I mean, this is essentially what happens when you democratize everything. It's just like saying, you know what, I'm going to run a site called MySpace, and it's going to allow bands, people to put their music online, bypass the record labels. But if somebody puts up a shitty single, I'm going to shut them down because I don't want no crap singles on my site, right? You can't do that, right? What you're going to do is you're going to provide a forum, and you're going to let the community moderate itself, and you're going to have a democratization of that discussion, whether it's music, whether it's politics, and let the chip fall where they may. And in this case, the truth actually won out.
But this was not, I mean, when you're talking about a MySpace song, that's a subjective choice. We're talking about facts here. I mean, there's a big difference. We're talking about
It wasn't. When the story was first posited, a lot of it was questions. You were questioning the circumstances. A lot of it wasn't fact yet. Upon further investigation, further digging, a lot of those questions ended up becoming dead ends, and the story sort of became discredited. But when it first got asked, it was pretty compelling. It's only when you start looking at the issues and you start digging further and further and further that it failed. So it's easy to say in hindsight, well, that story didn't go nowhere. But at the moment, it wasn't improper speculation.
Do you consider yourself a journalist or any of the people who write diarists journalists in any sense?
It depends on how you define journalism, and I find those distinctions to be pretty utterly meaningless. Sometimes I'll report. I got sources. You know, a good chunk of what I write is based on what I get from sources. So I guess that makes me a journalist.
But if one entry is more a piece of journalism or reporting and one is essentially an op-ed
piece. So what's that make me?
Well, I suppose a fusion, but I mean people,
right.
Fusion cuisine, but nevertheless, I'm asking this question because I know a lot of people read the Daily Kos, and you know a lot of people read the Daily Kos, so it's, I mean, there is some level of responsibility towards maintaining that particular status. I mean, you know, we're talking about, you're suggesting sometimes that you're a gatekeeper, maybe not.
Daily Kos is what it is because of the community and the format and the type of moderation that I allow in it. And I call. I mean, every once in a while, I'll get rid of an entire class of people, you know, like the conspiracy theorists. After the London bombings, remember the London 2 bombing?
Yeah.
There's a whole CIA and Mossad planned this thing out, right? And, you know, I had no patience for that crowd, so I banned a whole crowd. So you have entire sites on the internet that are predicated on hating me because I...
Well, wait a minute. I thought it was open source. If you're banning certain particular types
like
of things...
There's a point where if you keep on harping on a conspiracy theory, something that's completely been disproven without a doubt, then yeah. Now, if you're going to speculate on facts that are available at the moment and you're going to reach conclusions that end up being wrong, I have no problem with that. Jesus, if we're going to start shutting people down for being wrong, you might as well shut down the entire chattering class because they've all been wrong about a lot of things a lot of the time. So being wrong isn't... clearly, it's not wrong for people like Bill Kristol and Thomas Friedman and all these people that have made millions being wrong time and time again, right? So being wrong is not the bar we're setting. Is, you know, are you being responsible? And I think the original Palin diary did not cross the line into irresponsibility. Eventually, it did. And that's when the author took it down, and it was based on people finding new information that disproved some of his theories. Completely open source discussion.
Got you.
Now, I have rules at Daily Kos. It's a progressive site. It's not one for conservatives. So I'll act as a gatekeeper in the sense that there's a set of rules people must operate under at Daily Kos. And I don't feel any problem with that because there's a billion sites on the web, right? If Daily Kos isn't for them, they can go somewhere else. If I was a gatekeeper of the internet, it would be a different story. But thank heavens I'm not, because that would be the absolute worst job in the history of the world.
You mentioned multiple times in this book that essentially politics sometimes involves doing almost anything to win. Sometimes things that are really hard, some things that are, you know, really turgid from an ethical standpoint. If that's the case, and if politics does remain an arena in which one must be somewhat unsavory at times by necessity, well, what's the incentive to become involved with politics?
I have no... How am I going to put this? I don't care if people get involved in politics or not. The book isn't about how to get involved in politics or why you should get involved in politics. The book is, if you care about something passionately, you do not have to be a passive consumer. You do not have to wait for permission from anybody to take a more active role. You can take an active role yourself. And whether that's politics, whether it's music, because you didn't get that record deal, you know, you can, whether it's Hollywood, just put your stuff up on YouTube and who cares what the record labels say, I mean the studio moguls say, and so on. You can make those decisions. And this is what the book is about, right? People make their own decisions, and I have no interest whatsoever in telling them what they should feel passionate about or what they should put their efforts into.
But you do encourage them to vote for particular candidates or support particular candidates. So in a certain sense, you are, in fact, telling them what to
Not
do.
Not really. Daily Coast is really a site for progressive political junkies.
Even when you tell people that Hillary is doing this wrong thing or that wrong thing and the like? I mean, that's inherently...
I'm very clear. I don't do endorsements. I will say who I support. I'll explain why I support that person. I'll be open about it. But everybody needs to make up their own mind. I trust people. I mean, I'm not like these pundits who think that they speak for the American people. I have no illusions. I speak for myself. I will explain to them why what process I arrive at various decisions. But at the end of the day, really, it's their call.
Okay. Well, Marcos, it's a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Hey, pleasure.
All right, thanks.
That was fun.
All right.